Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
To the core where you had most of the detectives, union people, it was as if sort of like a wall just kind of like, I guess, crumbled in this just this torrent of emotions right point forward. You could just feel all these people hugging each other, tears coming, real emotion just pouring forth. It was very, very emotional. But, of course, from the other side of the courtroom, people rushing out, it's obviously an incredibly bitter moment.
So there you have it from WNYC's Arun Venugopal. All three police officers in the Sean Bell police trial not guilty on all counts. We had three defendants and three victims in this case, a total of 10 charges. Let's break down what they could have been convicted of. Detectives Oliver and Esnora were charged with first and second degree manslaughter for killing Bell and first degree assault for shooting Guzman. Detective Oliver was also charged with first-degree assault for intentionally causing injury to Benefield. Esnora was also charged with second-degree assault for recklessly causing injury to Benefield. Oliver was also charged with reckless endangerment, a misdemeanor, for firing a bullet that went through a window into someone's home. Detective Mark Cooper was only charged with reckless endangerment, a misdemeanor, for firing a bullet that landed in the AirTrain station nearby. But, as you have just heard, all three detectives not guilty, says Judge Arthur Cooperman, on all counts. WNYC's Cindy Rodriguez is outside the courtroom. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Brian. I heard Arun's description of inside the courthouse. Outside the courthouse was just as emotional. Once people heard the verdict, there was a loud scream. There was a lot of tears. The community affairs officers tightened up their security. They all sort of locked hands to try to keep people in place. I'm actually standing sort of in a crowd right now of press with the community affairs officers in front of me. The crowd is still pretty emotional. Many are screaming, there's no justice. And that's the scene so far out here.
How many people would you say roughly are outside the courthouse right now?
I would say a few hundred.
And what are people saying? I hear some loud speaking in the background. Do you know who that is?
I don't know who that gentleman is, but he's pretty upset about the verdict. I would say people are pretty angry, and many of the women were in tears. I think that the general feeling is, for these people at least, who are all Bell supporters, the general feeling is that there was no justice in this case.
WNYC's Cindy Rodriguez outside the Queens County Courthouse. We'll go back to her later on. Let's talk about how this verdict was arrived at and what the verdict means with Patricia Williams, professor of law at Columbia University. She writes the Mad Law Professor column for The Nation magazine, and Eugene O'Donnell, professor of law and police science at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, a former police officer and a former prosecutor. Eugene O'Donnell, Patricia Williams, welcome back, both of you, to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
Professor Williams, your reaction to the verdict?
I'm actually surprised. I think that the way in which I really can't imagine how even the reckless endangerment charges were not upheld, and I think that it's important to remember that I worry that the notion of self-defense of officers gets interpreted as though in an entirely subjective way. That it still really is, that standard is still subject to the norms of what is reasonable police action, and that police do not have an unlimited excuse to act out without regard for their role as public protectors. They're guardians of all our interests, and they can't cross over that line between, you know, reasonable self-defense. It's a normative standard. It's not simply an internal standard protecting anybody who is having a traumatic flashback, and it certainly doesn't excuse bad training. And they can't simply assume the role of, their role risks becoming that of public executioner if, in fact, every time a police officer is scared, they can shoot so wildly that it exceeds not just the object at which they're shooting, but also the AirTran station a football length away, the neighborhood, as in this case. I'm a bit taken back by this.
Eugene O'Donnell, your reaction to the verdict?
Well, I hope there'll be a chance to talk about policy changes that need to take place. This should never happen again. Somebody shouldn't be killed under these circumstances. But if you read the law of justification in this state, it's pretty explicit and pretty clear. It protects people broadly, but especially police people. The judges.
Professor O'Donnell, are you there? All right. I think we've lost Professor O'Donnell. Do we still have Professor Williams?
You do, yeah.
Well, let's look at some of the specifics. There were several main points of contention in this case. Whether the lead undercover police officer, Giscardus Norris, efficiently identified himself, or whether Bell and his friends had reason to think he was a thug because he didn't sufficiently identify himself, whether the main shooter, Detective Michael Oliver, who fired 31 shots, should have stopped to assess at any point, including before he reloaded his gun during the barrage and kept shooting, whether Bell's drunken driving, ramming Isnora and the police van, gave the officers legal justification, whether they so bungled the lead up to the shooting that it was criminally negligent or irresponsible, and more. Is it clear to you what evidence turned out to be the keys to Judge Cooperman's decision?
No. I mean, I'm sure that there'll be more explication of this as it goes on. But at this moment, I really was not prepared for such a complete exoneration of all the officers. These are charges that do not require intentionality as in murder. I hear a lot of the public discussing it as though they certainly didn't mean to kill them. Well, again, this is not about intending to kill them. It is about reckless endangerment. It is about a normative standard of they should have known that they were that this exceeded the bounds of what they are entrusted with as guardians, again, of the citizen and public trust. This question of the standard of police fearing for themselves in an exceptionally dangerous job is not a lower standard, as I hear many people interpreting it. It's actually a higher standard. That's why we train police officers. It is a dangerous job, but it is a dangerous job on behalf of all of us. And again, they cannot be judge and jury in the face of every fear. And the reasonableness of that fear is precisely what's at issue. And again, the degree of overreaction, which so echoes so many cases that we've had in New York, I think is what we ought to be focused on.
I think we have Eugene O'Donnell back on the line.
Brian.
Go ahead. So talk more about your reaction to the case. And you hear what Patricia Williams has been saying and what her concern is about any overreaction that comes from a police officer's subjective state of fear being acceptable and how that can lead to them being, in effect, executioners, even if that's not their intent when they come upon the scene.
Well, again, if you follow the law, as the judge apparently did, the law in this, this is not a case really about the crimes themselves. These are offenses that would be offenses if it wasn't for the fact that there was a justification. And the really important part of this is that the prosecution must, by law, disprove justification just about beyond all doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt. Not quite all doubt, but all just about. So it's a very, very hard standard for the prosecution. The police are put into harm's way. The judge is commanded to look at the case through the eyes of the people in the situation, in this case the police, who are going to a club where there's a report of problems, and there's evidence that came in that there was potentially a gun involved, and the judge must see the case in through their eyes, and he can't simply back away from the circumstances in which the officers found themselves that day. Again, there's a whole opportunity, I hope, to discuss policy, and every effort should be made so there's never a repeat of this, in the city of New York, but the law is pretty clear, and it does give the police pretty broad protection.
We can take your reactions, listeners, to the verdict not guilty on all counts for all three police officer defendants in the Sean Bell police trial. Again, if you're just joining us, not guilty on all counts for Detectives Cooper, Isnora, and Oliver. And for those of you tuning in expecting to hear the BBC NewsHour, this is special coverage of the verdicts in the Sean Bell police trial. I'm Brian Lehrer. These verdicts coming down just moments ago. With me now, Patricia Williams, professor of law at Columbia University, who writes the Mad Law Professor column for The Nation magazine, and Eugene O'Donnell, professor of law and police science at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, a former police officer and a former prosecutor. We have other guests to come as well. We will take your reactions on the phone and on the web at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to post a comment. We'll also be going back to the courthouse as we continue here. Professor Williams, Professor O'Donnell talked about the law being very clear. As a professor of law, what do you think that the law actually determined in this case, or the intersection between the facts and the law? Did the judge really have any leeway?
Well, I disagree with Professor O'Donnell's interpretation of this, that that through their eyes excuses absolutely everything. Through their eyes, and the standard is not beyond all doubt, as he did backtrack. I mean, but it does say reasonable doubt, and reason imports a kind of normativity, a normatively well-trained police officer, with whom we charge, you know, protection with the use of a gun. It isn't just anybody. It's not just through their eyes in some subjective sense. If they are drunk, it's not just through their eyes, and therefore, if they are traumatized, it's not just through their eyes. There's a limit, and the limit is the norm of what's reasonable.
Brian, I would invite your listeners to look at the New York Criminal Jury Instructions, which are easily enough found. They're online, and the relevant part of those instructions says that a reasonable person in the defendant's position, knowing what the defendant knew and being in the same circumstances, would have believed that too. So that is the standard the judge has to follow. He has to step into the shoes of the officers who were going to a club where there was allegations of criminal conduct, where there was evidence that there was a firearm, there was at least testimony about a firearm. So it's not a normative standard. It is a standard that's imposed by criminal jury instructions that have that presumably the judge followed as the trier of fact.
Reasonable and knowledge is the operative word. That's what I'm referring to as normative. It is, again, not an entirely subjective standard. They do not protect through the eyes of a loony person, for example.
I'm
pressing the envelope here, but it's, you know, and officers certainly have a more dangerous job, but ostensibly they have training to be able to handle those dangers, and there are conventions that they have to follow. There are procedures for drawing a gun. There are procedures under which circumstances you can choose. All of that, those provide constraints, and they are judged as
officers
in that role.
I'm going to jump in because Police Commissioner Ray Kelly is speaking about the case right now. Let's go live.
No, there have been no problems. Obviously, there'll be some people who are disappointed with the verdict. We understand that. We've had no history of violence since this incident began. As far as the vigils, the memorial services are concerned, we don't anticipate violence, but we are prepared for any contingency.
Police Commissioner Kelly taking questions from reporters right now.
We'll have to make a judgment on that based on the conditions as we see it. Say it again. Well, I don't want to go into specifics. We have prepared. We've done some drills and some practices with the appropriate units and personnel if there is any violence. But again, we don't anticipate violence. I'm sorry? I can't have a reaction, as I said. Any disciplinary action that may emanate from this case will ultimately come to me to make a determination on. So it's inappropriate for me to comment on the verdict. Pardon me, sir?
Any sense throughout the department about the verdict so far?
No, pretty early. Anything else? Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, Police Commissioner Ray Kelly taking questions from reporters on the verdicts just moments ago, not guilty on all counts for all three police officers in the Sean Bell police trial. Let's go back outside the courtroom now where Daily News columnist Errol Lewis is. Hi, Errol.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
I'm okay. What's the scene?
Well, the scene is there are some noisy helicopters overhead.
There's a big long wall of cops and court officers. There's a long line of people who never got into the courtroom, and some people are vocally very mad just about that. There are, you know, people are sobbing, people are holding up signs. Traffic is moving on Queens Boulevard. It's not a huge overflow crowd spilling into the street or anything like that. There are lots of satellite trucks and lots of press. We're waiting inside now for, I expect, in turn, the prosecutors and the defense teams, and, of course, the family is still inside with Reverend Sharpton. Pat Lynch is approaching the podium now. They're going to probably just come in turn, not in any kind of organized or synchronized way, but in turn to make statements. The defendants themselves, the cops, were hustled out through a back door of the courtroom immediately after the verdicts were announced, so I don't think we're going to see them.
Errol, are you surprised by these not guilty verdicts on all counts? You're trained as an attorney.
Yes, a little surprised.
You've been covering this case.
What surprised me was the reason, and the reasoning that the judge gave was that the most crucial part was that, I don't know if you can hear me, but the crowd is shouting at
me. We can hear you, Errol.
I can hear you. You can hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Pat Lynch is beginning to speak, and the crowd is pretty much trying to drown him out. But the reasoning that the judge gave really...
All right, and Errol, I'm going to jump in because let's listen to Pat Lynch, the head of the Police Officers Union, and the scene as he speaks. Take a listen.
But with this case, there's no winners, there's no losers. We still have a death that occurred. We still have police officers that have to live with the fact that there was a death involved in their case. But nonetheless, this sends a message to New York City police officers that when you were in that position, when you were in front of a courthouse, when you are in front of that court bench, that you will get fairness. And that is what New York City police officers need each and every day. Every time a police officer goes on the street, there is never a script. We have to deal with circumstances as they come. This was a tragedy with a death. It's a tragedy for all police officers that have to live with the difficult job we do, but nonetheless, we're grateful for this outcome. Thanks very much.
And Pat Lynch, the head of the Police Benevolent Association, the Police Officers Union, not staying around to take questions, trying to offer a bit of an olive branch to the families by saying there are no winners and no losers in this case, reminding people that the police officers still have to live with even a justifiably mistaken shooting, as the judge has ruled this to be, will have to live with the fact that they mistakenly killed somebody, live with that for the rest of their lives, and of course the two injuries. They will also face departmental charges or some kind of departmental accountability. Whether they will lose their badges is yet to be determined. They're already on modified leave. They've already had their guns taken from them. Whether that turns out to be a temporary condition or not, that has yet to be determined. They are certainly also still facing large civil suits, not against them personally. The money wouldn't come from their pockets. It would come from the city government. But nonetheless, they will be defendants in those civil cases. So the road is still long for the police officers involved, despite the acquittals here, but they have been acquitted of all criminal charges. They at least know this morning that they will not be going to prison and not have criminal records for anything that happened outside Club Kahlua 17 months ago today. WNYC's Arun Venugopal is outside the courtroom. Hi, Arun. What's the latest that you have?
Well, Brian, you mentioned the civil lawsuit just now. And that was something that, of course, will go forward, and the victims will probably take some solace in that. But that was actually one of the points that the judge raised as kind of hurting the prosecution's case. He said that aside from the fact that he could tell that they had motive to lie, perhaps for the benefit of their future litigation, that they also had inconsistent testimony, which he found very damaging, and that they had also renounced their prior statements, either made into the grand jury about a year ago or prior to that when the police investigated this. So all of these things were things that, you know, you could observe on a day-to-day basis actually in the courtroom, and they really kind of came back to hurt the prosecution in this case. And You know, after that, he made a very brief sort of narrative. Sort of, he summarized the incident as he saw it. He said, you know, there clearly was a heated incident in front of the club, Kahlua, that night. The SUV guy, as he's come to be known, his name is Fabio Kwaku. He likely had a gun. There was a threat to take it away by some of Sean Bell's friends or even Bell himself. And that in that environment, an atmosphere it is, Joe Guzman probably said, you know, go get my gun. And that is what basically prompted the officers to become concerned and for Jess Gardner's Nora, the undercover, to approach the car. And then he just basically summarized the collisions that happened, that his Nora got hit in all that chaos in his leg by the car, and that he saw Guzman move his body as if reaching for a weapon, is what the judge said. This is something that the prosecution said was, you know, ludicrous, but clearly the judge found that it was enough of an ambiguity in those motions by Guzman in the car to have led his Nora to credibly believe, given the, you know, the past few minutes what had taken place, to believe that he was perhaps reaching for a gun. So all of these things, he basically said, you know, it did not rise to the level of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that they had acted criminally.
Did the judge release a written opinion that you've been reading?
I haven't gotten one. I don't see anybody else with one, but it's possible. I've been outside the courtroom since the announcement.
How long did he speak from the bench?
I would say it was about 10 minutes. Yeah, it was very brief. Right when he entered, promptly at 9 o'clock. He's a very punctual man. And immediately there was a sidebar. He called the attorneys forward, briefly had a discussion with them for about 2 minutes or so, and came back. And, you know, he went straight into his reasoning. And, you know, summing it up, it was within a few minutes you realized, you know, you could kind of sense that where this was going.
WNYC's Arun Venugopal outside the Queens County Courthouse. We'll get back to you, Arun. Back to Patricia Williams, professor of law at Columbia University, and Eugene O'Donnell, professor of law and police science at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Professor O'Donnell, you wanted to say something about changes in police policy that would stem from this case?
Right. The New York Police Department, to its credit, and I guess it's a bad day to talk about its credit because this case is not to its credit, but the number of shootings that involve people that are not armed, that are totally unjustified in the New York Police Department, really, compared to any other major city department in the country, is low. But it needs to get lower still, and every effort should be made before police resources are committed to any project to make sure there's clarity about the mission. There's a reason to be there, that the police are not used, if any other agency can be used in their stead. This underscores that whole proposition. We almost need to have a Powell doctrine, a minimal use of the police when they're needed. We have a situation at Kahlua Club where the club continues to operate. How could that be even after this incident? How could we need to look at all of the regulatory agencies. We need to look at all of the ways that clubs like this can be shut down before we send an armed police officer into these situations.
Professor Williams, do you think that this case would have come out differently had a jury rather than a judge heard it?
I couldn't hazard a guess as to that. That's why jury selection is such an inexact science. I must say that I think a diversity of citizens would have had a good argument about it. I think that it's very clear that the defense attorneys thought that they would have a better chance with a judge rather than with 12 voices. I think there's a great deal of room for argument with this.
And that, of course, is an option that all defendants have, to have their cases heard by a judge rather than a jury. He is one man, one 74-year-old white and Jewish man. It's a hell of a burden for one man to bear. We only seem to hear about this option in police trials. Professor Williams, how often do other defendants take it?
Well, I think that, again, it's the selection of a judge as opposed to a jury is a depends, is a game of personalities to some extent. It's a game of guessing when it comes to jury selection in some cases. It's a political and psychological game. There are whole firms that specialize in reading body language, for example, reading people's clothing in order to be able to better select in, you know, when the stakes are high. I would just want to add one other policy consideration to Professor O'Donnell's, which is our use of undercover officers. Certainly part of the thing that I think aggravated what one sees as a recurring theme in these shootings is the use of undercover officers who are not who don't look like officers, who can be easily confused with people coming to mug or assault. And I think that that's the rules by which people announce themselves as police officers need to be reexamined as well.
Columbia University Law Professor Patricia Williams, John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Law and Police Science Professor Eugene O'Donnell. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with special coverage of the verdicts in the Sean Bell police trial. Not guilty on all counts for all three detectives charged in this case. And we turn next to Ron Kuby, civil rights attorney, and Richard Aborn, president of the Citizens Crime Commission, a group that studies the police and crime. Mr. Aborn, Mr. Kuby, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
Ron Kuby, are you surprised?
No, I am not the least bit surprised. It's typical, usual, and utterly predictable. I think that the die for this verdict was cast when the police announced their intention to do everything that they possibly could to avoid being tried by a jury of the people they allegedly serve and protect. They first made a motion for a change of venue, saying they couldn't possibly get a fair trial in Queens, which, of course, is New York's most diverse borough. And when that failed, they did what police officers usually do. They opt for trial before a single judge, usually a single white judge, in this case a single white judge, male judge who's in his last year on the bench. And that's a tactic designed not to get a fair trial, but to get an acquittal. And historically it's worked, and it's worked this time too.
Richard Aborn, did the judge do the right thing, in your opinion?
You know, I don't know if there's a right thing or a wrong thing. The judge heard all of the evidence, and he weighed that evidence, and he found, I don't know what the reasoning was, but I assume he found that the shootings were justified, and therefore there was no criminal liability. What the question is, did justice run its course? And I think the answer is yes. The district attorney's office took a long time to put this case in the grand jury. They were very meticulous about that. They did not rush into the grand jury, nor rush the case through the grand jury. They even kept the grand jury open when they were about to close it because the defense said that they had a witness that they wanted to put in the grand jury. The district attorney did not have to let that witness in, but they did do that. The case was then prepared for trial. The defendants, and these are defendants, even though they're cops, they have all the same rights as any other defendant in front of the court. They have the absolute right to make a motion for a change of venue. They have the absolute right to waive a jury if they choose to do so. Those are protected rights. They exercise those options. And the case was tried over a long period. So this case has had a very full airing, and I think that's what the people of the city of New York really need to understand. But let's not kid ourselves. This is a tragedy, no matter how you look at it. There's a young man who has lost his life. He has children. He had a woman who was about to become his wife. He was, by all accounts, a decent man. This is a terrible tragedy, and both sides have to live with this. The question is, to me, what lessons can we learn from this? What steps can we take to prevent this sort of thing from happening? And what steps can we take to try and heal the breach that has occurred between the community and the police? A breach
right.
that persists is one of the most stubborn
problems. You know, one way you get healing is when you get justice. And my dear brother Aborn gave a nice list of things that were part of the process. Yes, there was a lot of process here. But the ultimate substantive result was a miscarriage of justice. And at the end of the day, while we can intellectualize anything we want about the nature of the police, the facts remain that three police officers, you know, fired 50 shots, riddling a totally unarmed man with bullets and riddling other people who had absolutely no weapon with bullets. And nobody gets convicted for that. Can you imagine what would happen if the people were reversed and a group of young people claimed that that they thought a police officer, an undercover cop, was reaching for a gun and menacing them, and they riddled a car full of cops with bullets. Can you imagine what would happen if those people walked? It's unimaginable.
But, you know, Brian,
and this happened.
Brian, Ron is being just completely, totally.
Hey, hang on, one at a time.
And
go ahead.
Ron is also prejudging the facts, and that is wrong. We have a process to do that. Yes, this is a very, very difficult case. And on its face, one thinks, how could these people possibly be acquitted? But we know now from the testimony, from watching this case for so long, that there were other circumstances there, that these cops apparently did have some justifiable fear of their life. They didn't go out on a shooting spree in some wild way. This was not race-based. Two of the officers.
All right, one at a time. Let me get your reaction to some of the judge's reasoning according to him. Before announcing the verdict, the AP says, the judge made a statement indicating that the police officer's version of events was more credible than the victim's version. Here's a quote from the bench. The people have not proved beyond a reasonable doubt that each defendant was not justified, unquote. Beyond that, from the New York Times website right now, it says in the judge's remarks from the bench, he mentioned that incompetence is not necessarily criminal. So there are two of the arguments, two of the reasons that Judge Cooperman gave from the bench. Ron Kuby, what about them?
Well, two things. I mean, in response to both, a reasonable doubt is not a manufactured doubt. As we know, the human mind can always come up with some basis for doubting virtually everything. So to say that I have a reasonable doubt as a judge does not mean that his doubt is a reasonable one. And we've seen case after case after case, including this one, where doubts appear to be manufactured. And while it certainly is true that incompetence doesn't equate criminality, at the same time, under most circumstances, the most reasonable view of the evidence is when three people open fire 50 shots at a group of people who were totally unarmed, riddling three of them with bullets and killing one of them, at the very least, that begins to sound like manslaughter. You acted recklessly. You consciously disregarded a substantial risk of death when you did the things that you did.
And by way of background for our listeners, here's very briefly what the charges were. Detectives Oliver and Esnora were charged with first and second degree manslaughter for killing Bell and first degree assault for shooting Guzman. Detective Oliver was also charged with first degree assault for intentionally causing injury to Benefield. Esnora was also charged with second degree assault for recklessly causing injury to Benefield. Oliver was also charged with reckless endangerment, a misdemeanor, for firing a bullet that went through a window into someone's home. And Detective Mark Cooper was only charged with reckless endangerment, a misdemeanor, for firing a bullet that landed in the air train station about 100 yards away, but all not guilty on all of those 10 counts. Let's bring in some listeners for reaction. Alex in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Brian. I called you yesterday about, I predicted that that Detective Oliver would be convicted, and it looks like I was wrong.
Yeah, you're the law student, right?
That's correct. That is correct there, sir. I was a little surprised. I think that I guess I was wrong about how much politics would play a role in this.
You think politics played a role in this?
No, I don't. I think that the judge looked at it pretty much, you know, unbiasedly, objectively. And while, you know, it's a very difficult situation because you're not happy that person's dead about, you know, because of the situation, but...
You think it would have been politics if the judge had come up with that compromise verdict that you were predicting?
Yeah, I definitely think it would have been.
Alex, thank you very much. Ben in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ben.
Hey, how you doing, Brian?
Okay.
You know, it's funny. It's amazing that the most highly trained, supposed to be police officers in the world, every time there's an incident like this, they're allowed to have a normal person untrained reaction, you know, with the tunnel vision and, oh, you pull the trigger and it happens so fast. It's amazing to me. But, you know, going by the judge's reasonable doubt of fear of your life, what is to stop? This is my question. What is to stop? I'm an African-American person in New York City, and so I know that a police officer has a weapon. What is to stop me from having a reasonable doubt that in the course of, based on track records and past instances, based on everything, that I'm in a reasonable fear of my life. And if somebody were to take action against the police officer, how could you say you don't have reasonable fear that something that would be life-threatening would happen mm-hmm. to you?
Richard Aborn, how do you answer Ben's...
He's actually asking two questions, and they're both very good ones. The first question he's in essence asking is, should police officers be held to a higher burden when they discharge their weapons because they are professionals who are constantly trained? And the law has said no. The law has said that the police officers have to be treated in the exact same way as any other defendant that stands before the court. The second question is, in essence, what makes up a reasonable doubt? And frankly, contrary to what Ron said, a reasonable doubt is not any doubt. It's a doubt for which you have a very specific reason. And the law talks a lot about this. And that's why I constantly say you really have to hear all of the evidence. You have to have been in that courtroom every single day to understand what that judge heard. And you have to put yourself in the position of the judge to decide on the credibility of witnesses. Deciding whether or not people are fully credible or partially credible is an absolutely incumbent duty upon the finder of fact, in this case, the judge.
But so here's
I think
the
it's
fundamental...
very hard to second-guess these verdicts unless you've heard all of the evidence. Right.
Ron Kuby, what about the credibility, which the judge cited in that word from the bench?
Well, all witnesses in any criminal contest have some credibility issues. There's never any doubt about that. In fact, most of the world's most evil people have been sent to prison for life on the basis of testimony of witnesses who have committed horrific crimes themselves.
And the prosecutor said in his closing arguments, Mr. Testagrossa, that he could not vouch for all of the statements by his witnesses.
Well, that's right. And there's always inconsistencies. Nobody views the same events, especially events such as this, in precisely the same way. And if they did, if they all gave up and went up there and gave exactly the same story, they would be accused of being scripted.
Exactly.
And so it all sort of comes back to the question, do we believe this was truly an unbiased, fair trier of fact? Or do we have the dim suspicion, based upon the way we know life works on Earth, that for whatever reason, and we can probably guess what it is, white judges tend to view the police in a much different way than they view young black men? The fact is, judges like Judge Cooperman and his colleagues who have been on the bench forever, they have a very positive view of police. The people that they see, that they rely upon all the time, happen to be police officers. And the young black men that they see in their lives tend to be defendants that they're sending off to prison. And to think that justice in this case was colorblind, I think belies what we know about human experience. And again, it goes back to the strategic question that these police officers engaged in and that other police officers repeatedly engage in. Do anything except a trial by jury of the people who I serve and protect. Give me a jury in another county. Give me a mm-hmm. single white judge. But whatever you do, please, please don't have me tried by the people who see me on the street every day and know how I do my job.
Adam in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello, Adam.
Good morning, Brian. I'm very, very disappointed in the outcome of this trial, but I'm not surprised at all. And when you look at situations like this that happen, and you know it's a very tragic situation for both sides. However, this always seems to happen to young black men. So it's beyond the fact of, oh, there was a threat I feared for my life and I opened fire. This never happens in a suburban community with young white men. It never happens. So for us to say there's we have to have some lessons and some healing, there is no healing because there is never any justice for young black men. Especially young inner-city black men who fear the police for every do right. Because look at this case. You can be shot by the police for doing absolutely nothing. They never ascertained if anybody had a weapon that is open fired. And they'll never be convicted. Never in the history of America will they be convicted. And we have hope that the things might work out on the civil side. But this is just absolutely crazy just to think that black men, young black men, won't fear the police or cooperate with police when they do things like this.
Adam, thank you very much. I want to go back out to the courthouse now where Daily News columnist Errol Lewis has some more on the judge's reasoning as he articulated it from the bench. Errol, what did you hear from Judge Arthur Cooperman?
Well,
the point even before he announced the verdict where I kind of anticipated where it was going to go was when he said that he didn't find the testimony from the witnesses credible. Oh, I seem to have perfect timing here, Brian. Here comes the family down the stairs of Reverend Sharpton. They're going to be approaching the microphone in about 20 seconds. But just to say briefly, I think what the reasoning was, the prosecution, I mean, like every other recent law school graduate, I think I could have done a better job than any of the lawyers in the courtroom or the judge. The prosecution probably should have tried to clean up the many inconsistencies in the testimony of their witnesses. What the judge said was that there were too many inconsistencies, essentially, for him to rely on that testimony as credible.
We will take those statements live from Reverend Al Sharpton. And
you know what? He's walking right past us.
Oh, so he's not going to the microphones right now?
Well, contrary to what people think, it's not impossible to get him to walk past the microphone. He has his own radio show, as you know. He broadcasts for 2 hours a day, so he may be saving this for his own broadcast.
Exclusive. Ron Kuby, I want to ask you, as a civil rights attorney, these acquittals came in a New York State court. The U.S. Justice Department can bring federal civil rights charges against these officers. Do you expect that, and would you advocate it?
They can. I don't think that they will, and I'm really on the fence about whether they should. And to sort of unpack all of that, as a general rule, while the federal government can bring criminal civil rights charges against the police, they tend not to do that simply because there's a general sense that the verdict was wrong, or even a pervasive sense that it was a travesty of justice. There usually has to be something in the process that so deformed the process that the trial was fundamentally unfair. For example, in the Diallo case, where most of us disagreed with the verdict, the trial was televised. There were four African Americans on the jury in Albany, even though it was an out-of-town jury. People who watched that trial, even if they disagreed with the verdict, they had a pretty good idea as to how a rational jury could acquit those police officers, and the federal government did not step in. Here, it's sort of on the fence because, you know, the truth is Judge Cooperman took on this particular responsibility. He was not a jury. This wasn't a diversity of citizens. And in the federal system, you don't have the right to give up trial by jury.
All right, Ron Kuby, Richard Ayborn, I want to thank you both very much. Errol Lewis, a quick 20 seconds from you on the scene outside the courtroom as it's developing.
The Bell family and Reverend Sharpton are moving down Queens Boulevard. They seem to have stopped. They may be giving a statement here. They're mobbed by cameras, so it's hard for them to move even if they wanted to. I'm not sure whether they want to.
Right, and I'm looking at an overhead shot now where they are being mobbed by cameras as they're walking down the block, not stopping.
For the first time, Queens Boulevard is, in fact, stopped.
Our coverage continues on WNYC. The verdicts in the Sean Bell police trial, if you haven't yet heard, all three detectives not guilty on all 10 counts. There has been a little bit of trouble now outside the Queens County Courthouse, and WNYC's Cindy Rodriguez is there. Cindy, what did you see?
Well, Brian, it appears that the police were trying to escort the Reverend Al Sharpton, Sean Bell's fiance, Nicole Paltry Bell, and a few other supporters through a huge mob of press and other spectators. And it can get pretty crazy, especially when there's a million cameras fighting for their shots. And apparently, a scuffle broke out. I was on the outer edge of it, so I couldn't exactly see who was shoving who. But it lasted, I would say, about 2 minutes, and then everybody sort of dispersed, and Reverend Sharpton got into a black SUV and drove away. And
along with the family members?
I'm sorry?
Along with Nicole Paul Bell and any others?
Yes, I believe that she was with them, too. I sort of lost track of her once the scuffle broke out.
I'm looking at a overhead camera shot. I guess this is coming from a helicopter. And it doesn't look like there's much going on right now, at least in the area that I'm viewing. Has the crowd pretty much dispersed?
It has thinned out significantly. I was just, this little altercation happened on the side of the courthouse where, you know, there's a parking lot. In front of the courthouse where I'm standing, I still see crowds, but you're right, it is starting to thin out.
That's pretty quick. It's been less than an hour since the verdict was announced. So people said their piece. There certainly was yelling and screaming in the background that we heard earlier. There was a quick press conference or two. Pat Lynch from the PBA and one or two others. But the scene outside the courthouse is not going to be an all day, even an all morning scene, I guess, Cindy.
No, it doesn't appear that way, Brian. Several people, you're right, have already started to make their way home or into their communities. I did speak to several clergy people from Queens who sort of said, you know, they're encouraging their community to move on. While they don't think that justice was served, this was the verdict.
WNYC Cindy Rodriguez outside the Queens County Courthouse. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
With us now, we go back to Daily News columnist Era Lewis, back to WNYC's Arun Venugopal, also on the scene, and New York Times correspondent Michael Wilson, who covered the trial. Michael, do we have you there? Okay, I think we need to reconnect with Michael Wilson. Do we have Errol?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Errol, you know, what Cindy just said about pastors encouraging their community members to move on, there has not been the kind of public demonstration and series of public demonstrations around this case that we saw after the Amadou Diallo shooting. Why the difference, in your opinion?
Well, there are a couple of things. I think the system handled it very differently. If you compare, say, when the Bell family was on the steps of City Hall just the other day, and they had a very polite and cordial encounter with the mayor, compare that to the way Giuliani handled the Diallo case, in which, you know, when he wouldn't even meet with black elected officials, he wouldn't meet with anybody. And it led to all of the protests and so forth and the calls for a change in policy. So, you know, and that was true, I think, consistently, that the way the courts, the police, City Hall handled this partly accounts for a lack of outrage. I mean, the system was not perceived as unfair. The situation was clearly perceived as a problem.
Arun Venugopal, you were sitting in the courtroom through most of this case. Are you surprised at the outcome?
I wouldn't say I'm totally surprised. I mean, there were definitely aspects of it that I felt, you know, lent themselves to the prosecution's case. I kind of felt like one of the most telling bits of evidence was a statement, an interview with Trent Benefield from just within hours, within 1 hour, actually, of the shooting, where he was in the hospital. He was being interviewed pretty aggressively by the police, even as he's on his morphine drip. But, you know, from his perspective, it just seemed, he seemed completely baffled by what was happening when he was asked about, you know, from his perspective inside this car. And, you know, I really got the sense that for him and the other members of the car, that they just saw a black man with a gun who came out of the crowd, who was leaving the club, and, you know, just kind of started shooting. And I found it actually pretty credible. But at the same time, you know, we've you know, it's been more than a year that's passed. His own testimony on the stand in the trial definitely seemed to be avoiding some of the realities of what happened that night. He said he just covered his face with his hands when he was inside the car that night, and he didn't see anything happen. And that didn't seem to be very believable. There were other things that were said, and I think, you know, the judge touched upon it today, the fact that, you know, do these men have so much interest in future in the lawsuit that they're basically compromising, you know, not being completely forthright here on the stand. And there are other aspects of that as well that I think the defense was able to kind of like present the cracks in that. But, you know, going back to, you know, the police officers, I must say, you know, on the other hand, you had all kinds of what seemed to be slipshod sort of behavior on their part, just kind of like not necessarily presenting themselves very, very effectively as officers rather than just as undercovers or men with guns, those kinds of things.
And Michael Wilson from The Times, the judge did refer to that from the bench, saying, I think very tellingly, that incompetence is not necessarily criminality.
Correct. He said that that's something that's just best judged in another forum, sort of signaling that perhaps, you know, there is a price to be paid for the police action that night, but not in his courtroom.
A price to be paid in departmental action, and whether these officers are suspended or fired from the force or assigned to desk duty and things like that? Or do you also mean the civil suit in which the city might be forced to pay the victims millions of dollars?
Yeah, he didn't say. Any of those things are in play.
Tell me more about what Arun was referring to from the bench. When the judge referred to Trent Benefield's testimony, did he indicate that he thought Benefield was twisting his testimony to set up his civil suit?
He said, without naming Benefield at first, he said that the prosecution, many prosecution witnesses in general, were just not credible. And he listed several reasons, among them inconsistent prior statements, refuting prior statements, inconsistencies with themselves just on the witness stand, and interests, I forget exactly how he phrased it, something like outside interests. That we sort of took as a reference to the lawsuit, perhaps. Later, he specifically singled out Benefield and claiming that he was shot while running away, and said that he just simply dismissed that. He said forensics evidence proved otherwise.
We have a statement now from Mayor Bloomberg, who says, quote, there are no winners in a trial like this. An innocent man lost his life. A bride lost her groom. Two daughters lost their father, and a mother and father lost their son. No verdict could ever end the grief that those who knew and loved Sean Bell suffer. Judge Cooperman's responsibility, however, says the mayor, was to decide the case based on the evidence presented in the courtroom. America is a nation of laws, and though not everyone will agree with the verdicts and opinions issued by the courts, we accept their authority. And the mayor went on from there, but that's the beginning of the written statement issued by Mayor Michael Bloomberg today. Errol Lewis, do you want to talk about the civil case? Does that come quickly now? And how do you think the verdicts and what the judge said from the bench will influence the outcome of that lawsuit?
Well, I don't think it will. I mean, he by suggesting there will be other forums in which to deal with issues of carelessness and incompetence, is how he put it, you know, that suggests a departmental trial or indeed a civil trial. One reason civil lawsuits come after a criminal case like this is that it's such a high standard of proof that if they had been convicted, it would automatically establish the elements of what you need to prove in a civil suit, where the standard is not beyond a reasonable doubt, but a preponderance of the evidence, meaning, you know, a civil jury that finds, say, 51% culpability by the officer. So they're gonna. I imagine file so that they don't miss any deadlines, and they'll have a case that's pretty clear to anybody who's been following this stuff that the level of incompetence, the level of recklessness was indeed unlawful.
Errol, are you critical as a columnist and as a trained attorney yourself? Are you critical of the way the prosecution handled this case? Should they have been more explicit, for example, in trying to square the apparent contradictions in some of their witnesses' testimony that the judge referred to from the bench?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, it's only in retrospect, but during the trial, actually, I thought that they could, that they had a little leeway, frankly, because they had a judge who was experienced and understood that not every word out of everyone's mouth needs to line up in order for you to get a clear picture of what happened. You know, in retrospect, that they probably should have treated it as if it was a jury, as if it were 12 citizens from Queens who needed to hear a clear, consistent story with no deviations or with a minimum of deviations. They also probably, I think, should have brought in some experts to establish more of what normal police procedure would or should have been under those circumstances, and that didn't come through clearly in the evidence.
We're talking about The verdicts handed down about an hour ago in the Sean Bell police trial, all three officers not guilty on all counts. Talking about it right now with Daily News columnist Errol Lewis, New York Times correspondent Michael Wilson, who covered the trial, and WNYC's Arun Venugopal, who covered the trial. Arun, what happens next? Are there events planned for later today for people to react or express their outrage, those who are outraged?
There are some events in Queens. I actually do not know where. I was kind of curious to see, as Reverend Sharpton was leaving, where exactly he was headed to, but that basically drew the entire crowd away. When you're talking earlier about how it's thinned out, it's essentially non-existent now. All the people who are standing outside here are just waiting to go into court for their own thing. But I'm assuming that he's going to Jamaica. Where exactly, I'm not sure though. But there are other events planned in the evening in Queens.
All right, WNYC's Arun Venugopal, will check back with you later on. I also want to bring in now someone calling in who we know, and that is Janice Adams, historian, columnist, sometimes NPR commentator. Janice Adams, thanks for calling the show this morning. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me, Brian.
What are your thoughts?
Well, obviously I'm just outraged by it all. But I think it is important for us to understand the historical context of this. Each time this happens, whether it's Amadou Diallo, whether it's Rodney King, whether it's Patrick Dorisman, even something like Jenna, we act as though it's an unusual thing and that it is, you know, an isolated situation. Straight off the bat, I would say the very first editorial of the very first newspaper, black newspaper in the United States, 1827, refers to police brutality. The second thing I would say is that sometimes people equate this, and all of a sudden they give more human dimension to the police than we should. The police is a representative of the state. When you are an African-American person historically, you have been a victim, or you are likely to be a victim, of what becomes a form of state-supported terrorism.
But what is a judge supposed to do from the bench making a decision with that historical context? Doesn't a judge have a responsibility to humanize the police officers as any other individual defendant should be humanized? And doesn't the judge have a responsibility to look at the facts of the case almost in a vacuum in an ahistorical way?
There is no vacuum. The judge himself is there by privilege. Let's look at the number of African-American judges in the larger system. Let's look at the predominance of black people who are charged, whether justifiably or not. I recently sat on a grand jury. I was appalled by the factory of what that is. You know, there is no objectivity, and the fact that we want this objectivity that does not exist. This man walks down the street. He went to school in the United States. He was educated in the United States. He got the same propaganda that the rest of us got, that black men are a threat. So to talk about there should be some objective, I think the very first thing we have to recognize is that there's no such thing as objectivity.
So you think there's no such thing as objective guilt or innocence in this case?
Not
either?
In this case. No, there is not. Because you don't have, if we look at each of these, you know, the milestone cases, you don't have a comparable white, you don't have a white comparable situation to these things. You know, in my column one time I asked when it was the case of the police shooting a child because they said a candy wrapper was a gun. I asked the question, you know, maybe we should only have then black police officers because they don't really tend to have the same vision problems.
Well, you know,
that white
in this
police, and I know you're going to go to the idea of this one that all the police officers were white. I reject the idea.
Well, in this, all the
were people of
one was
color
black,
as
one
well.
Was half black, one was of Lebanese descent, I believe.
I misspoke.
Yes,
you're correct.
And,
but what I'm saying is, I knew that you were going to go there with my example, but my example holds true because the victim of these things are always people of color. Just because you now have a person who has gone blue, by being a member of the police force doesn't mean that he too sometimes has not been trained to see this black person as a threat. In fact, he may even have different problems because he sees himself, let's face it, who becomes a police officer? And that's something that really has to be looked at very clearly. I remember,
but could you send people to prison for something that you acknowledge is a subjective judgment as opposed to a provable fact?
I think the provable fact is 50 bullets in the body of Sean Bell. And I marched in that demonstration for that reason. I think that's the provable fact. A man with no weapons, a man who's trying to get out of the way of a hail of bullets and saying, "What the devil is going on here? Get me to the church on time," is dead in a hail of 50 bullets.
Historian Janice Adams, thank you very much for calling in with your thoughts today.
Thank you.
Michael Wilson from the New York Times, what happens next?
Well, the Bell family has said that in the event of acquittals, they would seek a federal civil rights case. Ray Kelly said yesterday that federal authorities have asked them to hold off on their own internal investigation while they, quote, monitor the case. Words to that effect. So I guess that's the next thing that'll be in play. Will federal prosecutors indict these officers? There's the possibility of departmental charges.
Did the prosecution try to prove that the defendants violated police procedures, acted contrary to their training for situations like this?
No, but that's not really their place to prove it. That's not against the law. They certainly suggested it and said it as much in arguments and whatnot.
Wouldn't there be an analogy from non-police work for the kinds of charges that were brought here if, in fact, they acted against their training? What if a crane operator or just the driver of a car makes errors that are their fault, that they should have known better than to make, but without malice, and winds up killing somebody?
Well, sure. At a minimum, if you're talking about the recklessness charge, I would have expected that to be a strong element of the prosecution case, but it wasn't, and it showed in some of the judge's reasoning. I mean, one of the first things he said was that strip clubs, generally, not this strip club, not any proof that this strip club was a horrible place, but strip clubs are places where narcotics and prostitution and other bad things go on, and therefore the police were justified in doing X, Y, and Z. So that the whole sort of setup, the whole police operation, you know, which admittedly was not on trial, but something about it needed to be established before you could say whether or not the police mindset or the police actions were justified or met a standard of recklessness. I would have thought it would have come up.
Let's take another caller. Carla in Manhattan, who I think wants to respond to Janice Adams, the previous caller. Is that right, Carla?
Yes. I would like for you to, as a former prosecutor and a person of color, would like when callers like your former caller called up and make the statements that she makes, that you follow up with some requests for specific statistics, examples of the sorts of things that she's talking about, because she speaks as if though history is this sort of static thing. You can go back in history.
I'm not a former prosecutor or an attorney. I'll clear that up. But go ahead.
But her, no, I am.
Oh, you are.
Right. And so history is not a static thing. History has moved ahead, and things have evolved. So the notion that somehow or another that this particular incident at a judge who's supposed to be a fact finder and the person who judges on the law is going to go back 200 plus years and act as if though the situation for blacks in this country is at now as it was then, mm-hmm, doesn't make sense. I think when those sorts of statements are made, we need to challenge them and to sort of put this into a context that's occurring now. Yes, there is historical behavior towards blacks that clearly filled with violence, etc., but that is not the situation currently, and to suggest that this is what's going on in the heads of these people as they're acting on that particular night, I think is a bit disingenuous.
So, Carla, let me get your reaction in that context to part of the statement that Mayor Bloomberg issued a short time ago. He said there will be opportunities for peaceful dissent and potentially for further legal recourse. Those are the rights we enjoy in a democratic nation. We don't expect violence or lawbreaking, nor is there any place for it. We have come too far as a society and as a city to be dragged back to those days. So he's talking about historical change regarding another piece of this, the potential for violence. Do you agree with the mayor?
I do, to a large extent, because I think that if that were to be the outcome of this, or the behavior of part of those persons who are outraged about the decision, in this instance, it takes back that movement and takes back all of the gains that people of color in this country have made over the generations. I mean, the situations now and racism in this country, and I would not deny that it exists, it does in fact exist, but it does not exist in the same ways that it did in the past. And so the strategies that one uses to fight against it have to sort of go and move with the times.
Carla, thank you for your call.
Thanks.
And Daily News columnist Ara Lewis and New York Times correspondent Michael Wilson, thank you for coming on with us this morning.
Thank you, Brian.
Okay. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Again, the verdicts in the Sean Bell police trial, all defendants, all the officers not guilty on all charges. We'll talk to City Councilman Leroy Comrie, who represents that district, next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and if you're just tuning in and have not yet heard the verdicts in the Sean Bell police trial, which came down about an hour and a quarter ago, not guilty on all counts, all three detectives. So let's get a reaction and talk about what is now going on and what might be going on in the neighborhood. We'll get a reaction and the thoughts of City Councilman Leroy Comrie, who represents the district. Councilman, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. Sorry to be here under these circumstances.
And I am very sorry for that, too. What's your own reaction to these verdicts?
Reading the perspectives that people had on the trial, the verdict is not a surprise to me. I'm just disappointed that the standards of conduct for the police department are judged at such a higher rate than individual standards.
What do you mean by that? What's that distinction?
If that had happened between two sets of individuals, there definitely would be some guilty verdicts and people would be in jail. The police officers seem to have a higher standard of opportunity and justice than normal people.
Considering their jobs, is that not right? If what they thought they were doing in that situation was trying to prevent Joseph Guzman from getting a gun and shooting someone.
There was no distinct evidence that ever showed that the police knew that he had a gun, that they acted with any definitive information that he had a gun. There was nothing in that I read from the testimony that clearly showed that they had a motivation or intention to ensure that he did not have a gun. As we talked about when I came on your show when this first happened,
mm-hmm.
The police procedure broke down here, and proper procedure in handling a situation like this just fell apart.
The judge said from the bench that incompetence is not necessarily criminality. Your reaction to that?
I believe that incompetence is not something that we should allow in the police department. They have too many life and death decisions to make as vis-a-vis the 50 shots that were fired because they just wildly reacted and panicked in a situation. I think that there must be some type of punishment that has to be given to people that have that level of incompetence.
Could it be that a form of justice in this case is that the police officers trying to do their jobs, if incompetently, do not go to prison, but that the city have to pay out large damages to the victims and their families in the civil case that will be coming?
Damages don't bring back a life. Damages does not change the culture and the focus of the police department, where they'd rather
criminal convictions don't bring back a life either.
Criminal convictions don't bring back a life, but there has to be a message sent to the police department that they have to change policies and procedures. And that's what the focus is going to have to be on now. That unfortunately, the police commissioner and his initial reaction to this incident did not feel that policy and procedures were the major problem here. We in the community feel that the policies and the procedures of the police department and how they handle incidents with the community have to be changed to prevent this type of thing. We all want lower crime statistics. We all want safe communities, but we want the police to be respectful and actually proactive in stopping crime, not reacting to situations where they have to turn to their guns to create resolution to a crime criminal situation.
That could
have happened if they had interdicted much earlier in this process, as we talked about earlier.
Who do you think is ultimately responsible for the incompetence? Is it Police Commissioner Kelly? Is it the lieutenant on the scene, Napoli, who came under a lot of criticism for his actions? He was supervising this whole operation. Who do you think?
I think all of the above. I think Napoli, clearly, as the commander on the scene. I think the commissioner for allowing untrained units and units that had not been properly given the manpower or the resources to do these types of busts. I think that the blame goes throughout the entire department from top to bottom.
With respect to the policy changes that you called for a minute ago, Police Commissioner Kelly did appoint a commission to study the policies relevant to this case and has instituted at least one change, which is that police officers who fire their weapons or maybe who injure or kill people, I'm not sure exactly where the line is, will be given breathalyzer tests. And, of course, one unknown in this case is whether the officers who were stationed inside the club as undercover officers were drinking. They were never tested.
That's an unknown, but anybody with common sense knows that an officer that spends 4 hours in a club undercover where they have to fit in is having more than one drink an hour. So for anybody to believe that the officer was not at least somewhat of diminished capacity because of the amount of alcohol that they had to consume is kidding themselves. So I think that only to have one policy change out of that entire set of review that was done is not nearly enough to make sure that the police department, which should be the best police department in the world, is enough. And there will have to be pressure put on the police department to do more.
Councilman Comrie, what will you yourself be doing in response to these verdicts in council or in the district? And what do you expect otherwise to be going on in your district later today?
I think that people will be talking about, I'm going to be moving around my district as much as possible, going to all of the local places that people congregate, and just reminding people to be calm, because anything other than a calm, thoughtful reaction to this travesty and this problem will not result in ensuring that justice is gotten, that there are changes made.
How fearful are you of something other than thoughtful reaction?
I'm not fearful at all. That's what the family has called for. That's what all of the elected officials and civic officials and the NAACP and Reverend Sharpton have called for calm. Clearly, there may be one or two people that want to express their anger, but I think that we're not at the time or at the age where people are going to want to be destructive in order to take out their anger. We have too many people that are invested in trying to improve the community.
Do you think that the federal government should now bring civil rights charges against these police officers? They have that option to, in effect, retry the case on violation of the victim's civil rights.
I'm not an attorney. I didn't get to hear any legal opinion on the civil rights thing, but I think that most of those that have been brought, to my recollection, haven't been successful either. I'm not against doing it if there's some real opportunity for success from it, and that there's some real opportunity to make some policy change from it. I would not close any avenue, but since I'm not an attorney, I can't give you a legal opinion on it. My gut tells me that if they were so completely acquitted on these criminal charges, the civil charges would be much harder to prove.
All right, City Councilman Leroy Comrie, who represents the Jamaica Queens area where this all took place. Thank you very much for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. Coming up in a minute, usually when you hear about remittances sent home by immigrants, it's in the form of cash. Well, with the world food shortage now, it is sometimes coming from the United States to other countries by individuals in the form of food. We'll hear about that in a minute.